Bruce?
I'm just waiting.
Okay. What I did just now is I turned on the recorder for the show so I can get this recorded for posterity here. Folks, this is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, California. And we've been off the air. This explains why I was not able to pick up the signal on my home PC a couple of hours ago. And this is just one of those fairly rare instances where we were just plain not available to you. But I know now for a fact that not only are we streaming, we're also broadcasting to the city of Santa Cruz. And this is the Mideast Migraine Show with your host, Ren Tawil. Now, by the grace of somebody here, we and some fortunate timing, I'm finally able to, I'm afforded the opportunity to interview someone who I have become acquainted with only on the internet. And this goes back, perhaps a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the situation. Bruce Gould. Wait a minute. Now, I need a quick review. What is it you don't want me to say about you?
Well, my location.
Okay.
But that's, anything else is okay. No personal information or my location, but everything else is fine.
Okay. Well, I trust that you will not... There's not much more I know about you than what you've already heard, if much to speak of anyway, so you will not let us know. Okay, let me give you the scenario. There is a year and a half ago, I had already been doing the Mideast Migraine Show, back when it was called Mideast Madness, in fact, going back to the fall of 2013, when I heard about a presentation that was going to be given in San Jose, California, just over the Santa Cruz Mountains from where I live in Santa Cruz County. Max Blumenthal, author, commentator, and interviewee himself, wrote a book entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Published in, I believe it was October of 2013, and he happened to get, or around that time, and he gave his presentation at the San Jose Peace and Freedom Center, or the San Jose Peace Center. And I had read some of his things over the air, his commentaries, etc., and I had seen a couple of fairly short but fascinating videos that he had put out about life in Israel. So I was already enticed to see him, and I was very pleased with his presentation that I went to see in this quaint old house, which is the location of the San Jose Peace Center. I purchased a copy of Goliath from him. And I made the decision. I was already so impressed with this young man, a Jewish American from the East Coast, I believe Boston, who, as a much younger man, in fact, as a student days of formation, I forget the word. Went to visit Israel on the Birthright program, I think it was. Israel and various American, Jewish communities in the United States sponsor the Birthright program to allow young Jewish men and women to visit Israel for a 10-day visit, all expenses paid, so that they may, as it were, visit the land of the Jewish people, the new ostensible home of the new Jewish homeland, which, of course, according to Zionism, is the old Jewish homeland, And so Mr. Blumenthal went on this program, did his stint there, and I apparently was able to see through a lot of the glitzy side that the Birthright program had intended to show these young, formative American Jewish people and give them the positive side of it. Eventually, after several years, as a young man, Mr. Blumenthal went back. He was already had at least one book under his belt having to do with the American Republican political party. And he went back to Israel, and the result of that visit was this book, 2 years old now, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Okay, so I made the decision, as I was saying, I was so impressed with the man, I decided to just go ahead and read his book, Goliath, flat out, on the Saturday edition of Mideast Migraines, which comes to you at 11 a.m. Pacific time every Saturday. Of course, that reading is now over. It took about 6 months over the course of a weekly two-hour program to get it done. Utterly fascinating material. And eventually I found myself on the Amazon website, where, of course, the book is made available. And as is the case for pretty much any of the books that are sold on Amazon, purchasers and other people who haven't necessarily purchased the book have an opportunity to write reviews and to make comments on the reviews of other people. And as you can imagine, this amounts to another internet chat room madhouse of people sharing all kinds of opinions and disopinions about things. Before long, one is able to recognize the people who are clearly in the Israeli camp or clearly in the Palestinian camp, and those who try to associate with all people as human beings. And so at any rate, I threw myself into the fray there, and I began making all kinds of comments. I printed up a review of my own. Although, and I admit this now, for the first time ever, I had not yet read the book. My review as such amounted to little more than an announcement that I had begun to read the book. So I was actually partway through the book when I wrote my review, and I explained to people what I was doing. And in the course of my writing the review on Amazon's web page, in the general category of book sales that they sell, some names of other individuals, whether their real name or pseudonyms that people came up with, began to sort of emerge to the surface. One of them was a gentleman who I eventually managed to interview on my radio program. We sort of tracked each other down. He is a Canadian Canadian, by birth and raised out in the Toronto area. He now lives in North Africa. He is a gentleman who is retired, and he chose, even though he is not exactly Muslim, certainly not by his upbringing, and I'm speaking of David, of course, Bruce. Mm-hmm. He chose to live his retired years among Muslims, which I found to be very interesting. So I did an interview with him, which was included on one of my shows. And let me go ahead and insert the fact that most of my recorded programs are available at the archives for the Mideast Migraines program. This is the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The archives for my programs are available at another website, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. Just type in Mideast Migraines and you will eventually see my programs, and go back several months, and you will see the title is something like Interview with David Vickery or David Vickery Interview. Mm-hmm. So I've already have his announce both his first and his last name. I had to say that in order to get people if they wanted to hear that interview. And so there's me and there's David, and then there is the gentleman that we have very fortunately on the line with us today. Bruce, you are I guess in my own self-aggrandizement, I came to see the three of us, you, David, and I, as a sort of the three musketeers of a kind of a team rooting for Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath. And I, in the case of both you and David, I became, found myself deeply respecting both the things each of you had to say on the comments regarding the reviews of the book and the way in which you said them. David, of course, was extremely civil, but right on the nose with his comments, and I found that to be the case with you. Also, you, Bruce, you are very civil and positive in your approach, but you also seem to have your own stash of material resources that you have available in order to flesh out certain things in your response to, in particular your response to the people who had bad things to say about Goliath. And why don't you go ahead and tell us more about your motivations for making, for contributing to the discussion?
Sure. Well, let me say how I got interested in the issue. First of all, about 2001 or 2002, I saw a map of Israel that included an accurate map of the West Bank and Gaza, including all the settlements. And as soon as I saw the map, I immediately saw that it was very similar to a map of South Africa and the Bantustans there. Yes. And I immediately realized that that sort of population distribution couldn't have happened by accident, that there must have been a lot of repression, frankly, going on.
It was not a natural phenomenon for a society.
Right. The Palestinians were squeezed into small areas. If you look at an accurate map of the West Bank, and I can mention where to find that, if you look at an accurate map of the West Bank, you'll see that it's like something out of Kafka. The land is divided up into different areas. Areas A, B, and C. There's Israeli only access roads crisscrossing the West Bank. There are all kinds of military installations and land that is forbidden to the Palestinians. And it just looked entirely like a crazy patchwork, and I immediately kind of thought that this couldn't have happened without, frankly, some oppression and some violence being used against the Palestinians. And at that point, I decided that I was going to learn about the topic, and in the years since 2002, I've actually personally met some human rights activists in Israel who know a lot about the situation. For example, I can mention Jeff Halper. That's H-A-L-P-E-R. He runs the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions.
Correct.
And I actually have his website up here. Jeff Halper is an interesting guy. He was born in Hibbing, Minnesota, which is where Bob Dylan grew up, and he says that he attended Bob Dylan's bar mitzvah, and then he emigrated to Israel at some point, and he is a anthropologist, and he started to see what the Palestinian situation was, and he founded this organization, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. Around 2005, I and a few other people spent an afternoon with him and the Palestinian man, Salim Shawamra, who had his house demolished. At that time, it was three times. Now it's six times. And I'm not sure where to jump in here, but I can tell you that one of the issues, one of the human rights issues in the West Bank and in Jerusalem, and in fact all over Israel, is are house demolitions. And since 1967, between 25,000 and 30,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished. And what I mean by that is that the Israeli bulldozers come in and they simply reduce the house to rubble. And the excuse for doing this in the overwhelming majority of cases is that the Palestinians who own the house have not filed a proper building permit. Now, this is sort of surreal. Since 1967, as I say, between 25,000 and 30,000 Palestinian homes have been demolished. And to the best of my knowledge and to the best of my research, not a single home owned by a Jew or a Jewish person has been demolished. So there's something going on there, obviously.
Clearly. And the whole thing about homes being demolished, well, my personal background... And incidentally, I lived in Minnesota in the Twin Cities myself for 35 years. And I eventually met Jeff Halper myself. I'll get to that story a little later on if we have a chance. It was during my time in Minnesota that I became aware of police in various U.S. cities demolishing homes that were... deemed to be or determined to be the domiciles of drug dealers, places where dealing went on or came out of. So that the initial message that I got about that was that the homes in particularly in rundown neighborhoods, lower class neighborhoods of the big cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul, eventually fell to the bulldozer as well. So that was my initial understanding, is that which I never fully understood, because I figured, why do they have to tear down an entire house because it's been determined that someone sold their dope out of there? Well, likewise, in the case of the Palestinians, the first understanding that I had, which I accepted initially, was that the reason why Palestinian homes were demolished is because they were the residences of terrorists, people who either outfitted others to strap on suicide vests, or they themselves were people who snuck across the border and shot at or threw grenades at Israelis, or they were somehow complicit in this. And that's the initial message that I got for the reasons for Israel demolishing the Arab houses. Now, in recent times, I've come to discover that the great, great majority of house demolitions demolishing Palestinian Arab homes doesn't have a thing to do with specific accusations of terrorism.
Correct. A few have, but the overwhelming majority of homes that have been demolished are simply because of building permits. And the total number of people that have been displaced or made homeless because of that is probably close to 150,000. So since 1967, the Israeli government has made about 150,000 people homeless, basically. Mm-hmm. I want to mention the
and that's
website.
Just from the house demolitions. That doesn't include instances of, say, the Gaza Strip.
Right, not even talking about the Gaza Strip. Now, I want to mention Jeff Helper's website, which has great information on the house demolitions and other human rights issues. It's at ICAHD, that's ICAHD.org. And if you just Google the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, it'll come up. And he's got great resources. He's got fact sheets and maps and so forth. And you can get an accurate map there, too, of the West Bank. You know, it's interesting. If you open an American newspaper and you look at a map of the West Bank, it's this sort of big blob, you know, maybe gray-colored blob.
Yes.
And people come away thinking that there's this big chunk of land that the Palestinians are living on, so what's the problem? Why can't they have their own state? But if you look at an accurate map, you'll see that there are Israeli settlements and access roads and military installations and forbidden areas.
Yes.
All over the place. And
yes,
you realize at this point that a Palestinian state is probably impossible. There isn't enough land for it. and there just isn't any land for a contiguous area for the Palestinians to live in. And the settlers, who numbered by now a couple hundred thousand, I don't know what the exact figures are, they are becoming an increasingly strong part of Israeli society, and I don't think that they're ever going to move out of the settlements. Jeff Halper, I recommend people look at his website.
Bruce? Bruce, if you can hear me, I cannot hear your voice, but there is... Okay, can you hear me now? Okay, Bruce, we had an interrupt that popped up. It says there's a problem with this call. Hold on while we try to get the call back. So I'm going to leave this up to Skype. Bruce here is calling us. His name is Bruce Gould, G-O-U-L-D, and he is an American Jew. Bruce, can you hear me now? Okay. Folks, this is not an uncommon feature of Skype. Bruce's Skype, for those who don't know, is a computer program which allows audio and, in some instances, video connections and communications between two people, each on their own computer console. Well, this interview is being done remotely. I'm here in California. Bruce Gould is in a location that he prefers not to be disclosed. Now,
I'm back on, man. I think we had a little glitch there.
Okay, were you able to hear all of my commentary for the past?
No, I was not. I lost you for about a minute.
We had a Skype-borne problem here, and the message was coming across on the screen saying that Skype is working on it. So, okay, I also just finished telling people your full name. Mm-hmm. Did not give your location, but I did indicate that this is an interview being done by remote. I'm here in California, and you are where you are. And I told people that you were an American Jew.
Correct.
Okay. So let's try and take up where we left off.
Right. I think we were talking about Jeff Halper and the house demolition.
Yes.
The house demolitions it's the main tool that the Israeli government uses to create, frankly, despair and terror among the
And we're having another interrupt problem here. Again, this is a perpetual problem with Skype. It could be weather, it could be internet traffic, which is causing this to happen. Now it's saying I've gone offline. The best I can do, folks, is to just sit this out. It's been a great interview so far with Mr. Bruce Gould. We've been talking for, according to my clock here, 24 minutes, almost 25 minutes now. And especially considering the problems that we had earlier. Bruce, speak up. Go ahead and just cut in. Go ahead. Well, folks, you know, this is not the first Skype interview that I have performed here. Luckily, the two big ones that I've had, with the aforementioned David Vickery and one with my good friend in France there, Greta Berlin, came off without a flaw, as I recall. This is just not one of those instances. Bruce?
All right, we'll be back again.
Let's just plow through.
All right. So I was saying, you're still there, right?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay. I was saying that the home demolitions are the main technique that the Israeli government uses to create despair among the Palestinians. And they do it in a very cruel way. If you have if you're a Palestinian family and you get a notice that your home is going to be demolished, you don't know when the bulldozers are going to come. They do it so that it happens randomly. It could happen tomorrow. It could happen a year from now. You have no idea what the status of your home is going to be.
Yes.
And this is an issue that you can see with all of the human rights groups that work in Israel. I want to mention some resources here that I'm looking at. If you go to, there's a blog called 972. It's 972mag.com. That's 972mag.com. And they have a, it's journalism that's updated every day on what's going on in Israel, what's going on in the human rights situation. One of the journalists, Haggai Matar, I met him when he came into the U.S. and I drove him around years ago, and he was just in high school at that point. He was what was called a Sheministim, that is a refusenik, somebody who refuses to go into the military service.
Yes.
Because he felt that the Israeli army was brutal towards the Palestinians. So I recommend that people look at 972mag.com. And there's another source that I recommend, the Mondo Weiss website. Mm-hmm. There is a gentleman named Phil Weiss, and he created this website that has really good analysis and news. And it's I'll give the web address here. It's MONDOWEISS.net, MondoWeiss.net.
Two excellent sources, MondoWeiss.net,
yes.
And 972MAG, is it?
It's 972MAG.com.
I have used both of those. I have read a number of articles from both of those sources, and I will vouch for the quality of those sources.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. There are so many different ways I can go just from what you've told us here. After the successful reading of Mr. Blumenthal's Goliath on air here, and again, those are available at radioforall.net, my readings, or you can just buy the book at Amazon yourself. It's entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. The author is Max Blumenthal.
Mm-hmm.
And the current, you know, after that reading, I decided to continue to read other books, and I'm now on the fifth book over the past roughly 18 months, and this one is written by Anna Balzer, herself also an American Jew.
Mm-hmm.
The book is entitled Witness in Palestine, an American Jewish Woman in the Occupied Territories. And speaking of, my mind immediately went into some of the last material that I one of the last entries that I read from the book last Saturday. She was talking about how the checkpoints, there are some, you know, more or less permanent checkpoints throughout the West Bank, which really do little or nothing to contribute to the security of the Israeli people. All they do
right.
is they complicate.
Now, the checkpoints are an interesting issue. There's a couple hundred checkpoints now. I'm not sure how many exactly the changes. But the interesting thing about the checkpoints is that many of them seem to have been set up just to make life difficult for the Palestinians. The entire Israeli policy towards the Palestinians is to make life so difficult that they have to leave. In some areas, you have to go through two checkpoints just to go and buy a carton of milk.
As I was saying, there are the more permanent or quasi-permanent checkpoints, and then there are what they call flying checkpoints. Mm-hmm. That can be set up literally overnight or in the middle of an afternoon. Just, and again, this has nothing to do with real security for Israelis. For someone like Ms. Balzer or Mr. Blumenthal, who has personally experienced these, it becomes obvious to them. And of course, this is totally obvious to the Palestinians who live there under occupation, that these checkpoints are for the purpose of complicating the lives of Palestinians, slowing down their movement and their economic
yes.
growth, and making life literally impossible, trying to encourage them to pick up and leave so they do not have to be driven out as they were in 1948 and again in 1967.
67. Yes. I think a lot of people, by the way, you mentioned 1967, and I think a lot of people are not familiar with what happened in 1967. Most people have some knowledge of 1948, but in 1967, during the war, Moshe Dayan and others evacuated, simply marched Palestinians out of their villages at gunpoint. The Economist uses the figure 250,000. So 250,000 Palestinians were driven out of their villages and sent to refugee camps or other places in the West Bank. So there was a lot of ethnic cleansing going on. Now, the important thing to remember is this. A lot of people say, well, the Arabs attacked us, so we were just defending ourselves. But the people that were driven out of their villages in 67 and in 48 were civilian non-combatants. They were completely innocent of any kind of violent crimes.
That's right.
They were driven out simply because of their ethnicity. And Israel has been trying to cover this up. In fact, yes, it's interesting. There's a an organization in Israel called the Jewish National Fund, and they're responsible for planting forests.
Yes.
And when I was a kid, I would send my pennies and nickels to the Jewish National Fund, as Jewish children often did at that time. And I have now since learned, and this is covered in Goliath, that the Jewish National Fund has planted fast-growing pine trees over the remains of Palestinian villages to sort of cover them up.
That's right.
There is a park in Israel called Canada Park, which is the site of a number of covered-up, buried Palestinian villages. In 1948, 500 villages and towns were simply, you know, bulldozed. And,
yes.
I'm not sure exactly how many villages suffered that fate in 67, although, as I say, there were probably about 250,000 people driven out. And these were civilians. They were civilian non-combatants, you know, just gardeners and kindergarten teachers and potters and people who were just leading their lives. And they were driven out of their homes. And
first, they were driven out in 48, either at the point of a gun or they personally experienced the gunning down of fellow villagers and family members and were, quote-unquote, convinced to leave for that reason, or they were reacting to news of this happening in neighboring villages. This is what prompted the refugee flight from those communities, those villages, right, and cities of long standing, and in believing that they would have an opportunity to return to their homes, generally people do after an emergency of some type or another. Israel, of course, captured 78% of the land of the British Palestine Mandate. It would not allow them to come back in. And then the Israelis promptly bulldozed these empty towns. And they said so in so many words at the time. They did this so that the Arabs would have no villages to return to. They actually had said so in so many words.
Yeah. I want to recommend another book here, one that I read years ago. There is a Israeli author, he's passed away, called Baruch Kimmerling, K-I-M-M-E-R-L-I-N-G. Baruch Kimmerling. And he actually emigrated to Canada some years ago, and he passed away there. He says in the introduction to this book, Politicide, Ariel Sharon's War Against the Palestinians. Well, I'll repeat that. Politicide, Ariel Sharon's War Against the Palestinians. And that is, I think, a more accurate history than what you might normally read. And these events are covered, are discussed in that book.
And upon Mr. Sharon's death last year, he was, of course, lauded from some quarters as a lover of peace and a great peacemaker, whereas anyone who takes a close look at his personal history and how, and his involvement in the creation of Israel will come face to face with many indications that he was, if anything, a psychopathic murderer.
He certainly had a disturbing, let's put it like this, in 48, he was known for throwing bombs into houses and not always checking to see if they were inhabited or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we can leave it at that. But you know, to me, 48, the events of 48 were terrible enough. And let's be fair, there were massacres on both sides. The Deir Yassin was a massacre of Palestinians by Israelis, and there were massacres going the other way too. But in my view of history, the real point in which things went irretrievably bad was 67. I think that up until 67, the situation could have been repaired and the Palestinians could have had a stake. But it was in 67 that the home demolitions really started in earnest. Immediately after the 67 war, a couple thousand Palestinian homes were immediately demolished. And there were people in Israel who warned against what was going to happen. There was one man in particular who I'm thinking of, Yehoshua Leibowitz, I think his name was. He was a scholar, a Jewish scholar, a scientist, and he warned that if the territories were not returned, and that if Israel had to continue ruling over masses of Palestinians, that the situation would deteriorate into what it is today, which I think resembles an apartheid-like state very much.
And it wasn't a terribly difficult conclusion for them to come to. Once, you know, the common saying is conquest is easy, continual occupation is not so easy. Once the Israelis captured the balance of Palestine, not to mention the entire Sinai Peninsula in 1967 and that sliver of land from Syria, the Golan Heights, it became apparent to many of them before too long that there is an impending problem with what to do with those people. Israel clearly did not want to absorb them into its voting full citizenship population. But, you know, short of granting them complete independence and, in effect, some kind of Palestinian state, the only other option would be to kill all these people or drive them away. And I think that the unhappy medium that Israel has come to since then is this very, very slow, painful migratory genocide, which it can be described as in part, involving... getting, well, frankly, not too many of them to leave. And then you have instances where there is a slow destruction of the population through wars and through various kinds of extrajudicial killings, etc. You know, Palestinians in a village begin to hold a nonviolent demonstration, and one thing leads to another, and some of the younger kids start to throw rocks at soldiers who are armed to the teeth to begin with, and of course this becomes an excuse for the soldiers to shoot the children.
Yeah.
Let
me recommend another source for human rights here. There's an Israeli human rights group called B'Tselem, at B apostrophe, well, you can, it's btselem.org. That's btselem.org. And they have fantastic information about, shootings of innocent people, home demolitions. I'm looking at the website right now. I can see these headlines: Civil Administration Demolishes 4 Home in Khalat in Northern Jordan Valley. Masked soldiers enter Palestinian homes in Hebron in dead of night, order residents to whip their children and photograph. I mean, it's just a horror show of human rights violations. And B'Tselem has a reputation for accuracy. Obviously, with the number of cases that they deal with, they may get some things wrong, but they have a reputation for pretty good accuracy in their reporting. And you can use it. They also have a list of links to other human rights, Israeli and worldwide human rights groups. So you can check out a lot of this information on B'Tselem. And there's also some movies that really interestingly portray the Palestinian situation. There's 3 movies that I've seen in the last 2 years. There's one called 5 Broken Cameras.
Yes, I've seen that, yes.
There's a movie called The Gatekeepers, which is a series of interviews with the former heads of Shin Bet. Shin Bet is one of the Israeli security agencies. And there's another movie that I recommend highly that people watch. It's called The Law in These Parts. The Law in These Parts. And it's about the Israeli legal system and how it treats Palestinians.
The Law in These Parts is one of the is a fairly rare example of an accurate rendition of what's going on in the territories that was presented on by the public broadcasting system in the United States here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's on Netflix, and I think you can get it online. But if you just poke around a little bit, you can find it. So that's a really good introduction to what's going on there. And I think the American mainstream press has been they've gotten a little bit better in the last year, but they're very hesitant to really report this stuff. I think that Israel has devoted a lot of energy to monitoring and manipulating the U.S. news. There's a whole army of Israelis who feed information to American news sources. So I think you really have to look at some of these other things to get an accurate picture. You're not going to get an accurate picture of what's going on just by reading the mainstream American press.
Absolutely not. The broad example you gave of the flat map of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, which just shows a blob without giving any of the Swiss cheese details of the Bantustans. This is something which is not, you'll see evidence of it occasionally on maybe a show, possibly a show like 60 Minutes or of course the Law in these parts. But generally, no, you only hear about the West Bank. And then there's the Gaza Strip, which supposedly is a free state now, when in fact it is technically still considered to be under occupation because of all the various restraints that Israel and Egypt impose upon the Gaza Strip. One does not see the details of the map of the West Bank the way you and I do.
You mentioned Gaza. According to international law, Gaza is still an occupied territory.
That's right.
It's considered occupied because the Israelis control absolutely everything that comes in and leaves. If you live in Gaza and you want to go on an international trip, you want to go to Italy or something, you have to get permission from the Israeli authority. And the Israeli authorities usually don't give it. So it's still occupied territory. People say, oh, the Israelis left in, 2008 or 2005.
They pulled the settlers out, the Jewish settlements out of the Gaza Strip, only to replace them and add to their numbers in the West Bank. And it was obviously a public relations ploy to get some people, the more naive people in the world, to say, hey, how beneficent it is of Israel to pull out the Jewish settlements, but it's had these three terrible massacres over the last 6 years that have happened. And, speaking of access into or out of the Gaza Strip, it was the same year that Hamas came into power in 2006, elected by a free and internationally monitored election, despite whatever else one wants to say about Hamas. In 2006, also a group of Americans and others in Europe began to talk about improving the lot of the Palestinians who live in the Gaza Strip. They couldn't do it by land because Israel was far too restrictive through the land borders. They couldn't do it by air because there's no place to land. Israel bombed and pockmarked the runway and the so-called international airport in the Gaza Strip. So this group founded the Free Gaza Movement and decided to go in by sea. And that's what I and 43 others, plus the many other human rights people who supported this mission, we all flew into the island of Cyprus two years later in July of 2008. And we, over a long period of waiting for the two vessels, which the Free Gaza Movement purchased to sail out of Greece, as stealthily as they could, because they knew the Israeli Navy was trying to monitor and locate them, we eventually sailed into the port of Gaza City and stayed there for a week, and then we sailed back to Larnaca, Cyprus. The only reason we were able to successfully get in and out of Gaza, despite the Israeli military's continued promises to stop us from doing so, even though they knew fully well that this was a humanitarian and human rights mission, we were at the last moment we were allowed to go through only because world opinion had been very momentarily brought upon our mission, and they convinced the Israeli Navy to not stop us and to let us pass. And that's why my skin was saved anyway. I was very lucky on a personal basis to be able to attend that mission. And there were some half dozen other sailings, likewise from Cyprus to Gaza. And then the war, the one that started 2 days after Christmas, Operation Cast Lead, began, ended in January, I believe, of the next year. And ever since then, there have been many attempts, including two flotillas with a half dozen or more ships to get in. And in every single case after that first war, Israel stopped the boats. They commandeered them. They roughed up the humanitarian crews of these vessels, including killing 10 Turkish citizens, including one Turkish American citizen, on May 31st, 2010, mostly in execution-style killings of the largest ship of the Mavi Marmara, of that flotilla, and they injured over 100 more people in that one instance. And this is essentially the story. That story has happened over and over again with each new attempt to sail into the Gaza Strip, and they should have been able to sail into the Gaza Strip. I mean, there is, even though the Gaza is not a full-fledged autonomous or otherwise independent nation, there's no good reason for Israel to stop this. But they did anyway, and they got away with it since Operation Cast Lead. And it was on that voyage that I met Jeff Halper, who agreed to, well, he's, you know, we were of like mind. I didn't know who he was, of course, before I met him, but he and I ended up being, we were buddied. We were the two buddies, as for safety concerns, everyone was encouraged to find a buddy on whichever, we were two sailing boats, or two former Greek fishing trawlers on our vessel, the SS Free Gaza, and then there was the SS Liberty. And that's when I found out that he, in fact, was born and raised in northern Minnesota. And he chose me as his buddy because he knew at the time I was living in the Twin Cities. And that was actually it was a terrific honor to have that recognition, that acknowledgement from him, considering what a great man he was. He had already been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize.
Yeah, Helper has been nominated, and I hope and I sort of have a sense that he may win it, because I believe that the Nobel Committee is going to make a statement about the situation, and if he won the prize, it would really focus some attention on what he's saying.
That would be wonderful.
I'm looking at right now at his website, and he has an interesting essay up there, "The Israeli Elections, a Game Changer," that he just published a week or two ago, and I really recommend his website for analysis and facts. You can't do any better. I'd also like, you know, you mentioned Gaza, and I want to recommend another resource, if I might. Norman Finkelstein is a author. Both of Finkelstein's parents, by the way, were concentration camp survivors, so he obviously understands the history of the Jewish people and so forth. There's a book of his called Method and Madness, The Hidden Story of Israel's Assault on Gaza, by Norman Finkelstein, and anything he writes is I'm looking at the Amazon reviews now. He gets reviewed very highly. Scholars have praised the accuracy of his work. Needless to say, the Israeli government despises him. In fact, I don't think he can really go to Israel anymore. He's a persona non grata. But I recommend that book, Method Madness, The Hidden Story of Israel's Assault on Gaza. And you know, people frequently say, well, you know, why won't the Palestinians recognize Israel? And in his book, Method and Madness, he gives many, many quotes from Palestinian leaders who will say that they're perfectly happy to live with the Jewish people in their midst. They just don't want to be colonized. And I think that's the issue here.
Well, very much so. The short answer, of course, to your own question is, everyone demands that the Palestinians recognize their oppressors.
Right.
And that's
right.
What it comes down to. Let me just adjust my volume here. I don't want to get any unnecessary feedback. We only have Assuming you can still hang in with us, up to 18 minutes more of 17 minutes more of interview sure. time on this program. I want to sure. give you an opportunity to say something about your concerns about not, you know, you don't want people to know where you're located in the country during this interview. I want, if you can say anything about, to explain why that's the case. And I also want to get into the subject of internet trolls, of the Hasbaristas. I'd like say something about those.
There's this term called Hasbara, which I understand is a Hebrew word. It is, how can I explain this?
To literally translated to explain?
It's to explain, yes. There are a whole army of people who attempt to rationalize or justify or explain Israeli policies. And usually their arguments are very simple. They talk about the Holocaust. By the way, Norman Finkelstein has a great book called The Holocaust Industry. And as I say, he's hardly a Holocaust denier since his parents were concentration camps survivors. But he talks about the use of the Holocaust as a justification for the policies of Israel. His book is called The Holocaust Industry, Reflections on the Exploitation of Jewish Suffering. And the topic of Israel is extremely emotional. People feel extremely strongly about this. And there are a lot of Jewish people who identify with the role of the victim because of the Holocaust. And let's face it, Jewish history has been awful in Europe. I mean, I'm well aware of that. And I'm not trying to explain that away, but the Hasbaristas use Jewish history as a justification or an explanation for Israeli policies, and they can be quite vicious, as you can see from some of the discussions of Goliath on Amazon. So they are to be avoided.
I just wanted to throw in the fact that it's also very important for people to understand, because there's of all the mythology attached to the creation of the modern state of Israel, the 20th century state of Israel, one of the biggest myths is that Israel was somehow owed to the Jewish people of the world because of the Nazi Holocaust, whereas technically right. there's no connection between the two of them. Israel was not promised in any way, shape, or form as a result of the Holocaust. It technically had nothing to do with the Nazi Holocaust, other than the fact that, obviously, because there were already many Jewish immigrants into Israel up to that time, it continued to be, as they say, it expanded from a stream to a flood of Jewish immigrants after the Holocaust. You know, the path was already blazed in that sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And let me say that personally, I have no interest in any kind of position that implies that the Israeli Jews should leave. I think that the only solution is moving towards a one-state solution.
Absolutely.
Palestinians and the Israelis have equal rights. Now, there's a author, Ali Abu Nima. I'm sure you're familiar with him. He has a website called the Electronic Intifada.
Yes.
It's also an excellent website, and it's written from the Palestinian point of view. And Ali Abu Nima is a proponent of a one-state solution. And, you know, people say, this is a typical Hasbara line, that, you know, the Palestinians just want to kill the Jews and so forth. But let me point out that in South Africa, the whites under apartheid said the same thing. They said that if apartheid ended, that they would be thrown out, they'd be thrown into the street. And it hasn't turned out like that at all. And I think at this point in time, I don't want to speak to what the Palestinian attitudes were in 1970 or 1980. I don't know. I wasn't paying close attention then. But based on my meetings with Palestinians and people who know Palestinians, like Jeff Helper, I believe that at this point in time, the Palestinians really just want equal rights. And so it's just going to be a power struggle. I don't think that the Israeli, the Jewish Israelis are willing to give up even in one iota of power at this point. So I think that the struggle is going to take on the dimensions of the struggle against apartheid back in the 60s and 70s. I think you're going to find the same sorts of things going on. You're going to find an increasing boycott and sanctions movement on the economic side. I think already a number of European countries have passed non-binding resolutions to recognize the Palestinian state. I think that effort is going to become stronger and stronger. And I think that in the next 10 years, you're going to see a lot of similarities between the situation in Israel and the situation with apartheid in South Africa.
I have to admit that I'm somewhat more skeptical than you. What I have seen over the decades since, and I was in the eighth grade in 1967 when the war, the June War happened. And so that pretty much marked, because of the rumblings in my own family and the anger that I could sense frothing amongst my Palestinian father and his siblings, etc. That was the beginning of my introduction to the politics of what was going on. But since then, I have just seen one example after another of Israel doing something really bad, like committing atrocious slaughters in the Gaza Strip and needless attacks in the West Bank. And people start to say, people who are more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause begin to say, now it's going to start to turn around and world attention is going to be brought around. And it just doesn't happen, really. I mean, people begin to talk about them things, but Israel has become, among other areas, very masterful at kind of laying low and letting these things just sort of pass until there's more positive rumblings about Israel, and then they ride that and people somehow seem to forget about the latest atrocities. Israel is masterful at avoiding accountability at their own actions. Bruce, can you say something more about this business, about the how does the troll business work, for example, on the Amazon.com website where people review books that they buy?
Oh, I think that there are a number of people, and I actually do believe that there are paid Israeli agents. I know that sounds paranoid, but I do believe that there are paid Israeli agents or people who are volunteering to work for the Israeli government who
Blumenthal
will put up the same arguments on websites like the Amazon comment section and so forth. You know, it's funny. I heard Jeff Halper speak a while ago, and he spoke at the library not all that far from where I live, and he gave his talk. And after the talk, there was a gentleman who stood up, a young Israeli guy. He was the only person in the room wearing a suit. Mm-hmm. He had an Israeli-American flag pin on his lapel, and he was very smooth. And, you know, he started talking about how his father was really worried about what was happening in Israel. His father was worried that he was losing Israel, the Israel he had grown up with, and so forth. And it was such a polished performance. I have to tell you, I know this sounds paranoid, it was such a polished performance that I felt that he must have been paid by the Israeli government. I think that the Israeli government is very concerned with their international image, and I think that they do spend a lot of money to counter it. But let me get back to your pessimism, and I'll tell you why I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic because in the last couple of years, since, say, 2000, a number of very high-ranking Israeli security agents and people in government have been using words like apartheid. I just read a couple of weeks ago that there is a ex-chief of the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, who said that Israel was headed towards an apartheid situation. I can't remember his name. His first name is Deir, D-E-I-R, and his last name begins with an M. And I can't quite remember his name right now. But you see a number of very high, even Tzipi Livni, who's in the Knesset, once said a couple of years ago that there was a danger of that it was going to be very difficult, not impossible, for Israel to remain both democratic and Jewish. If it was going to be a Jewish state, then it wasn't going to be a democratic state, because it was going to rule over, you know, 4.5 million Palestinians. So you see a lot of people high up in the government who are starting to really understand and talk about the situation, and I don't think you saw that in 2000. I'm a little bit more optimistic than you are, but I think it will probably take another decade. There is an organization in Israel called Blue White Future, and let me just look this up right now. And it's interesting because it was founded by two people, and one of the people was a head of Shin Bet. Here we go. I'm looking at it right now. It's BlueWhiteFuture.org.
Okay.
And they are sounding the alarm. I'm looking at their website, and they say that what Israel needs to do is unilaterally withdraw to the 67 borders. Mm-hmm. There's no security concerns there. Ami Ayalon, who used to be head of the Shin Bet, was one of the founders of the organization. And you can look at their website, and they say that if Israel continues on its route, that it's going to become an apartheid state. So there are Israelis now who are openly saying this kind of stuff, and some of them are very high up in the Israeli security apparatus. So I'm a little bit more optimistic than you, and I hope that optimism is not unfounded.
I haven't given up completely, Bruce. I was letting you know the history as I have seen it play out, and I'm trying to be realistic. I mean, I don't want to completely dash people's hopes, but I expect people to be realistic and to pay close attention to how Israel has continually, instance after instance, survived every challenge for it to be accountable through the United Nations, through its press. It just has a way of mowing through these people who demand accountability on its part. Do you have anything more to say about your concerns about privacy, or do you have specific fears? Have you been threatened? Do you have what's going on?
I have been. I don't know what the word is. Not threatened, but I have been. Let's say hounded by some people. Let's just leave it at that. But I think the situation is changing. And by the way, let me say that one of the techniques that the Hasbaristas use is claiming that any criticism of Israel is somehow anti-Semitic.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that gives me hope is
even in the case of Jewish people like you, you are somehow anti-Semitic, right?
Correct. The term they use is self-hating Jew. Mm-hmm. Right? Any Jew who criticizes Israel is a self-hating Jew. But I have to say that I'm optimistic because I don't have any problem finding Jewish people who are starting to understand what's going on in Israel. I think the situation is changing.
But, it's very daunting. It's a daunting task to get Jewish people, particularly outside of Israel, to educate them, because ultimately it will involve literally convincing them and proving to them that they have been literally lied to all of their lives on some very, very key things.
And let me toss out another resource. There's an organization called Breaking the Silence.
Yes.
Google Breaking the Silence. Mm-hmm. And this is interesting because I've met some of the people from these organizations personally. And there's a sister organization called Yesh Gvul, which I understand means enough is enough in Hebrew.
Okay.
And these are organizations, and again, I want to mention that Breaking the Silence. And these are organizations that consist of Israelis who have served in the army or in the police force in the West Bank, and they want to talk about what they've seen and what they were asked to do. And there are a number of video testimonies up on Breaking the Silence, and you can see what goes on pretty clearly when you watch some of these video testimonies, and it's shocking. And I don't think that 10 or 15 years ago that many Israelis were willing to speak out about what they saw and what was happening. So I think that's another resource, especially for Jewish people, because these are Jews who are talking about their experience in Israel.
Yes, in the case of Breaking the Silence, I've understood that to be exclusively or predominantly former service people, men and women who have served in the IDF and have been on duty in the occupied territories.
Well, I think it's all. I think it's entirely people who have been in
yes.
occupied territories. And I, as I say, I've spoken to some of these people in person. I've driven them around to their speaking engagements, and they have some amazing stories to tell. And by listening to their stories, you really understand what a military occupation entails. I mean, this is something that people don't grasp, that the occupation of the West Bank is a military occupation.
Right.
And in any military occupation that's gone on for this long, it's gone on for half a century, that there is a certain dynamic that develops between the occupiers and the occupied. And that, needless to say, it is not healthy. But I urge people to go to Breaking the Silence and watching some of those video testimonies.
Yeah, I've been aware of that, of the Breaking the Silence group for a while now, and it really does need to go mainstream, well, viral as it were, if not
yeah.
ultimately mainstream. Okay, Bruce.
Yeah, I'm really glad I talked. I hope my conversation was helpful. I'm going to have to sign off pretty soon.
Yeah, it's I got a minute to 5 o'clock California time here, so I do indeed have to sign off. I hope to see more of your contributions to whether you're talking about Amazon or 971. I'll keep an eye open for your.
It's 972.
And magazine and online. And I just want to encourage you to keep up the good work. Don't be afraid. Don't be intimidated. And I know this may indeed even involve, for all I know, it involves members of your family who may be giving you the cold shoulder. I don't know. But it's understandable that might happen.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, thank you very much, Mr. Gould.
Thanks, friend. Take care, and I'll talk to you some other time.
Great. Terrific. Thanks. Yeah, I have your number.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye. And this is the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You heard a 1-hour and 6-minute interview with Mr. Bruce Gould in Chicago. I'm sure nobody in the world has heard of him before this interview, but he's someone that I've been wanting to touch base with for a while, just based on his contributions to comments about one book in particular that was written about a young Jewish American man's experience in the Israeli-occupied territory of the West Bank, what should be Free Palestine. And worthwhile endeavor, despite all the terrible technical difficulties we had. We were the whole building complex that the station is a part of here was out of power, and it was beyond our immediate control, but then it was taken care of. And so we finally got the station back up and running about halfway through the usual 2-hour time period of this Mideast Migraines program. Don't forget radioforall.net, radio4all.net for the recorded podcast of this and other programs of mine and perhaps some other Free Radio Santa Cruz programs. I'll be back with you next Monday at 3 in the afternoon, and of course Saturday at 11 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time for the continued reading of Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, an American Jewish Woman in the Occupied Territories. Thank you so much. Take care, and ta-ta. Stop this.